Thank you, Bob. It's 440 on the beat, 720 WGN. These texts rolling in. Worst Bears quarterback you ever saw, 312-981-7200. Peter Tom Willis, Caleb Haney, Will Fuhrer. I didn't even know who Will Fuhrer was.
No clue.
He played one game in 1992. Jim Harbaugh had 13, and Will Fuhrer had one. So keep those coming in, 312-981-7200. Joining us now on the phones, he's a Chicago guy. He started his baseball career working for the Cubs in the 80s, and he's now a senior advisor, I should say, with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And the new book is called The Big Chair. We welcome Ned Coletti back to WGN Radio. Hey, Ned, how's it going?
Hey, doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on today.
You're a Chicago guy. Who's the worst quarterback you ever saw for the Bears? Curveball for you.
Both of you. I may have a couple more lists for you.
That's a nice dodge by you. So you've been with the Dodgers for a while. This year, a very special season, 102 wins, another division crowd. Your team is the favorite in Vegas. What's this journey been like this year in 2017?
It's been a very amazing year. They just got done losing 16 out of 17 and 20 out of 25 after having maybe the greatest 80-game stretch ever. They were relentless in their approach. They've been really waiting for this month of October to get going since the last time they played in Chicago in October a year ago. I think that left a bitter taste in their mouth, and I think they seem very determined to make amends for getting beat by the Cubbies last year.
Well, growing up in Chicago, obviously your allegiance is with the Dodgers, but what was it like seeing the Cubs win the World Series for you?
You know, it was amazing to me. Might have been the greatest 10 days of my baseball career. After we were eliminated and I could no longer root for the Dodgers at that point in time. I came back for 3, 4, and 5 at Wrigley and then went on to Cleveland for 6 and 7. And the whole experience being at Wrigley Field, in fact, I talk about this a little bit in the book, being at Wrigley Field for the sixth game of the LCS, I had my uncle to my right, who was 83 years old and who wasn't allowed to go to the 45 World Series because he was too young. My dad and my two other uncles wouldn't take him. And to my left a year ago was my son. So we had this three-generational gap. And as we got to the ninth inning, and as you recall, Cubs were 5-0, place was on fire. I mean, people were so revved up. And you know, you can tell when you've seen as much baseball as I have, you can tell when a game is going one way or the other most of the time. And I knew we were just outs away from packing up. I looked at my uncle and I said, "How you feeling about all this?" I mean, he was almost in tears. And he says, "You better not screw this up now, pal." So I said, "If you're watching the game, don't worry about it. We're not going to."
I get chills hearing stories like that. You know, for a lot of us who, you know, Sam and I cover sports, we're around sports, we love sports. For me, it was always like, I wanted to be a professional athlete as a kid. And then you get a little older and you realize, well, that's not going to happen. But I told myself, I have to be around sports. I have to do something involving sports because I love it. I love baseball. I love football. I love it all. Was that the case for you? Did you want to be a player? Like, where did the root of all this come from? When did you realize, okay, maybe playing as a professional athlete is not going to happen, so maybe I can do something else in the sports industry?
Exactly the same path. My first game at Wrigley was April 15th, 1961. I can remember it vividly. And I caught the bug as a little kid. And I love the Cubs. I love baseball. Ernie Banks, my favorite player, first player I ever got an autograph from. Got to know Ron Santo later in life, both as a player and then when I was working for the Cubs and he was broadcasting, we became very, very close. So the seeds of my career were kind of planted at that point in time, hanging out in the bleachers at Wrigley Field. But at 5'8", I knew I wasn't going to become a professional athlete.
Hey, so Jose Altuve is doing pretty good. He's about 5'6". He may win the MVP.
I root for him every day because of that. But I went to Triton. I went to East Lydon High School. Went to Triton College for a couple years, JC. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college, so we really didn't have a roadmap educationally. Then I graduated from Northern Illinois with a degree in journalism, and I wrote sports. Like you broadcast and you talk about it on the air, I wrote sports for about 4 years, went to Philly, covered the NHL for a little while. My dad got sick back in Franklin Park, and I came home, and fortunately Dallas Green and Bob Ivock, who was the PR director at the time, brought me back and gave me an opportunity to start my career and also be with my dad in his final days. He died later that year in 1982 and hang with my mom, who was going through a tough time, and my brother, who does Bears stats for decades now, was still at Northern Illinois. So a tough time in my life turned out to be a blessing in a few other ways when my dad died.
Ned Coletti with us on the beat, 720 WGN, a sports executive for the Los Angeles Dodgers. The new book, The Big Chair, The Smooth Hops and Bad Bounces from the Inside World of the Dodgers. We'll talk about that coming up. But I had a question about Tommy Lasorda and the influence he still has with the Dodgers. How important is he, and how influential is he still to this day in Los Angeles?
Well, he just turned 90 the other day, and he's probably the in a lot of ways the face of generations in L.A. of baseball, including Vin Scully, who retired last year after 67 years of doing the games on TV and radio. Tommy is iconic in so many ways. Was a big help for me. He hated the fact that I worked for the Giants before I worked for the Dodgers. I said I couldn't help that. And then I actually had the great honor of having dinner with Frank Sinatra one night when I was working for the Cubs. And we got around to talking about sports, and Frank says, you know, I love Tommy Lasorda, you know, I'm very close to Tommy, but I grew up a Giants fan. And so I kind of kept that in the back of my mind, and one night the Giants are playing the Dodgers, and Tommy's giving Brian Sabia and I a hard time about something, and I look at him, I said, hey, you know, one time I heard that Frank Sinatra was actually a Giants fan. And he goes, and he went off. I mean, it was like one of those moments where you say, and he actually threw us out of the booth because he was so upset that I would be so blasphemous with Frank's loyalty. Although I told him at the end, I said, you know, I got this from a pretty good source. I got it from the man himself, you know. But Tommy's a very, very good friend and somebody who loves Chicago. I tell you what, he spends, especially in his 70s and 80s, as much time as he could spend in the city of Chicago, he would.
All right. Can you share us any more stories about Frank Sinatra? What was that like hanging out with him?
Casually, yeah. Dinner with Sinatra, no big deal.
It was actually set up by another Chicagoan, the great comedian Tom Dreesen. Yeah. And I had helped Tom with tickets for a long time for Wrigley Field stuff, and he was a huge Cub fan. Actually, I got him to be a bat boy with the Cubs. He was like 40 years old, and he always had this dream. So I had to go to Don Zimmer and Jimmy Fry and say, I got a bat boy candidate. And they said, is he old enough to drive? I says, yes, by about 25, 26 years, it's Tom Dreesen. And they just kind of rolled their eyes, you know. But he had a show in San Francisco. I was working for the Cubs. I had no allegiance to the Giants at the time. And he invited myself and a guest, and I brought our old pitching coach, Billy Connors, with me. And went out to the show with Tom and then came back. And I had always wanted to meet Sinatra. And Tom was a little bit leery, and he says, you know, Frank's a little bit edgy sometimes. And, you know, he doesn't want to just meet people that he doesn't know ahead of time or know that he's going to meet them. So I don't think we're going to be able to do this. So I get a little agitated with Tom. I mean, I've left him about 2,000 tickets by this time, you know. And so we're driving back to the city in San Francisco, and we go to this restaurant, and he says, you know, you guys have to go back to the hotel. I said, Tom, you can't even let us say hello to the man. He says, well, let me see if he's okay. So they close this restaurant down for the Sinatra party. So we go in there, and he says, yeah, come on back, get in line with the owner, the maitre d', the chef, say hello, then you got to go. So that's what we did. And as we're walking out of this private room, Sinatra goes, where are you guys going? And I said, well, we're just going to go back to the team hotel. We were introduced as members of the Cub organization. I said, we're just going back to the team hotel. He says, you're not staying for dinner? I says, no, we just wanted to go back, you know. And he says, so you're going to insult me? And so I looked at Dreesen, and I said, Mr. Sinatra, I'll never insult you. We're going to stay. I looked at Dreesen, and I says, there you go, buddy. How are we doing so far?
The problem is, when you go to dinner with Sinatra, you're up until 5 in the morning, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. And being from the Midwest at that point in time, it was 7 in the morning. So when I did get out of that dinner, it was about 3 or 4 hours long. It was unbelievable. It was like a dream almost. And then, you know, I got out and I got back to the team hotel. Cell phones weren't even around yet. I got back to the team hotel and called all the buddies I grew up with and all my uncles who grew up with Sinatra and Martin and the Rat Pack and all that, and said, guess what I did last night? You know, so a cool night.
Your best, your favorite Ron Santo story?
Oh, goodness. I have so many. Ronnie, I had Ronnie almost arrested one night in Philadelphia. We were on the team bus the night before. And coming back, and he says, the day before. And he says, you know, I'm going to stay in a clubhouse tonight. We're going to watch this heavyweight fight on closed circuit TV. So I know where he's going to be when the game's over. So he watches the fight, and I hear from, might have been Tom Brenneman. I hear from Brenneman that says, Ronnie had a tough time coming back from the fight watch the fight in the clubhouse, coming back to the team hotel. The cab driver took him to the wrong place. So he really got on this cab driver. So we get on a bus and we're driving to the stadium now the next afternoon. And I got Brennerman sitting next to me and Ronnie's behind me. I know he can hear me. I go, hey, how about the new ordinance they got in Philly where you got to be very, very kind to cab drivers and you can't be abusive. You can't shortchange them. You got to tip them well and treat them with the utmost respect. Otherwise, you know, you can actually go to jail. And Brennerman goes, yeah, I heard that now. You know, boy, it's can be a little touchy from time to time. You know, he's not letting on that he was with Ronnie last night. And I hear Ronnie, I can see Ronnie kind of like getting a little closer to hear the conversation. So we got to the vet. They were in the old ballpark. Then we got to the vet. And the stadium operations guy for the Phillies was a dear friend of mine, Mike. And I said, hey, you got a couple security guys that can come in here and jostle Ronnie a little bit? He goes, oh, I'd love to. So between innings, second and third inning, two policemen show up. And they got a piece of paper rolled up, and they walk into the booth as soon as the inning ends, and they go, Mr. Ron Santo here? And Ronnie's sitting down like three steps down from the hallway, and he goes, yeah, I'm Ron Santo. And he, you know, and he looks like he's going to sign something for the guy, you know, like an autograph. And the guy says, we're here to arrest you after you, how disrespectful you were to a City of Philadelphia cab driver last night. And Ronnie, there's an inning, there's like a 30-second break, you know, a 60-second break, right? And Ronnie's going, hey, the guy took us the wrong way. This guy deserved everything I gave. And he starts screaming at the policeman. And the guy says, let's go. We're going right now. Because now Ronnie starts to get a little bit belligerent with the policeman trying to defend himself. It was all a made-up skit. And now I'm standing behind the policeman, and I'm laughing so hard. And he sees me, and he you know, he used to call me an affectionate Italian nickname, you know? And he says, I says, all right, we were just playing. And my now, you know, they're back on the air. And Ronnie's still not on the air because he's up in the hallway yelling at me for the policeman. You know, but Ronnie was one of my dearest friends. I know him since I was 10 years old. He come back to the – but I grew up in Franklin Park. We had an Italian delicatessen there, still there, Alan Joe's. And Ronnie would come there and buy some prosciutto. I was 10. He was probably 24, 25 years old, starting to really get his career to take off, and became friends at that point in time.
You get to know these players pretty well, too. We're talking with Ned Colletti, a baseball executive for the Dodgers. Judd Surratt told me a story that he talked about with you about Deonor Navarro, about all the pets he had. Didn't he have, like, a tiger and a bunch of pigs? Didn't he have all these crazy animals that he used to have in his house?
I think that's right, yeah. I mean, there's always a different story. There's always, you know, people, we think when we meet people, like that's the first day that their life started, and we're always wrong because they have so much different things that went on, you know, in their past. I'm pretty sure it was Navarro. I've had a couple guys that had collections of exotic animals, and of course, as time goes on, they start collecting cars.
Cameron Lowe had snakes. Yeah. He would bring a snake into the clubhouse and scare Alfonso Soriano to death.
You know, the craziest thing I ever had to put into a contract, Rafael Furcal, who I signed in L.A. a couple times to be our shortstop. When a player signed a pretty hefty contract, they would always give money back to the Dodgers Dream Foundation, much like they probably did the Cubs Care in the day and still do. And he said, I'm going to match this. I want to match what I'm giving you. I want you to help me match something and help me do something. I said, what would that be? He says, in the town I grew up in, the DR, there's no fire department, no fire truck. Can you help me get a fire truck? I said, you got it. So we got a fire truck that they were retiring in L.A., had it painted in Dodger blue with Rafael Furcal's facsimile signature across the front. And then Tommy, of course, had all the connections and all sorts of ways of the world. And so we got it shipped down to the little town of Dominican where Rafael Furcal grew up.
That's outstanding.
You are just full of stories. You are full of them.
It says there's a fire truck. Yeah.
That's incredible. Ned Colletti with us on the beat a couple more minutes here. The book, The Big Chair, The Smooth Hops and Bad Bounces, Wednesday, October 4th. There's a signing here in Chicago, Sulzer Regional Library, 4455 North Lincoln Avenue. You can meet Ned at 7 o'clock. What was the smoothest hop? What was the worst bounce for you?
Well, some of the worst bounces, unfortunately, happened in Chicago. And I was a young executive beginning my negotiation journey when Greg Maddux left the Cubs. So there's great detail, almost a step-by-step detail when Greg left for Atlanta way back when. Also when Andre Dawson, this is a smoother hop, not for the front office at the time, but certainly for Andre Dawson, when he did come to the Cubs, a negotiation that took place. If you remember, he signed a very low-valued contract, and then baseball was hit with collusion right after that. But my time with the Hawk is Conoco Lanier, as well as signing Sandberg to his four-year, $28 million contract. That's some of the Cubs stuff in there. Some smooth, some a little rocky from time to time. But it gets into a lot of the trades, a lot of the different things. I mean, back in L.A., we acquired Manny Ramirez at the last minute for the people of the Dodger lore, or even baseball, who love to find out what happens inside the room. What does it look like? Almost like the X-ray. We got the story of Manny, and then we traded for Adrian Gonzalez and Beckett, a few guys. A lot of signing stories like Greinke, Ryu, Puig, but also a lot of Cub things, because that's where I cut my teeth, and that's where my love for baseball began, right at Clark and Addison 50-some years ago.
You are full of stories. I wish we had more time. Ned Coletti, the author of The Big Charity, still in the front office for the Dodgers. Good luck with L.A. until you meet the Cubs in the NLCS, and we will talk to you. The book signing is Wednesday, October 4th, here in Chicago at Sulzer Regional Library, 4455 North Lincoln Avenue. Go see Ned Coletti at 7 o'clock. Thanks, Ned.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me on today.